Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Elise Lunan, Chief Content Officer at Goop and co-host of the Goop Podcast. Today's guest is often referred to as the most powerful woman on Wall Street. Her name is Sally Krawcheck. She is our next guest in our special 8-episode series that we're hosting in partnership with Banana Republic called Women on Top. I'll tell you a little more about that before we get to our conversation. Some of the most interesting businesses, or maybe all of the most interesting businesses, were born out of curiosity, a desire to explore, to ask questions and share answers. This is the space that Gwyneth was in when she started Goop. It's also the space from which Banana Republic was founded back in 1978, when two California creatives with adventurous spirits began upcycling military surplus clothing. And the rest was history. When we talked to the team at Banana Republic about partnering up on a special podcast series, their vision revolved around the idea of living a life with no boundaries. This is the inspiration behind their clothing today. It drives how they source premium materials from around the world, the ways they choose to innovate with their designs, and how they think about infusing style with substance. This is all on display in their fall collection, which combines iconic Banana Republic styles with a modern twist. To see it all and to shop Banana Republic's fall collection, head to bananarepublic.com/goop.
Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like it's unbound, it's limitless, but we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves, and that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Today is no exception. I'll let Elise fill you in on her extraordinary guest. All right, over to Elise.
Sally Krawcheck is the CEO and co-founder of Elvest. When she realized the investing industry was designed, as she puts it, by men, for men, she had an aha moment. Sally set out to change that, and Elvest was born. She built a company whose goal it is to help women realize their financial power and get them on a path to achieving their biggest investing goals. Today, Sally and I talk about why women can be really good investors. We talk about the double standards we have as a society about money, why women are stereotyped as a gender that isn't good with money, how for men, money is thought to be the source of happiness and power, but for females, it's about budgeting, being frugal, and how that can lead to uncertainty and isolation. And why today money is a woman's number one source of stress. Sally tells us what it's actually like to have been the most powerful woman on Wall Street, what happens when we let go of the stigmas we have about money and go after our biggest investing goals.
So, you know, in this moment, it's, you know, it's the power. So the first thing is it's good for women because it's get your hand off my leg money, right? I'm out of this relationship that doesn't work for me money. I'm starting the business I want to money. It's also good for the economy. When we have more money, we spend more money.
Okay, let's get to my chat with Sally Krawcheck. Thank you for being here.
Elise, thank you for having me.
The most powerful woman on Wall Street.
In the day. in the day.
I think it should just go on your gray
okay.
zone, right?
If you insist. I certainly have the wrinkles to prove it.
Yeah, no, seriously. Probably the most powerful woman in Wall Street at the toughest time to be on Wall Street.
Oh. Well, you know, it's interesting because my third week on Wall Street was the crash of 1987. Obviously, I was on Wall Street when I was two. That's the only way that math works. But I remember getting there and just like, what in the world? And then through the internet bubble and then the financial crash and of 07, 08, and then I got fired for returning client money. I'm the only executive who did. I mean, the stories I can tell.
Oh, I know. Please tell them.
Oh,
so
gosh.
Wait, so will you give us a crash course? I know your story, but how sort of what that experience was like, and then we'll get to Elvest.
Well, the experience, what the experience was like, it was all
on
out
a spiritual
war.
And physical
it
level.
Was, it was. Let's just put it this way. I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. I went to the University of North Carolina. I thought I was going north. I honestly thought I was going north. I went to New York, to Wall Street, because that was sort of the Silicon Valley of the day. If you could, you did. My father pretty much forbid me from moving to New York because it was too dangerous. He was right. On my, maybe not my, like my second day, I'm standing next to my desk wearing the height of Charleston fashion. And this, I smell cigar smoke. This guy walks behind me and says, what kind of beep, ing, discount maternity wear is that? And I thought, who is that coarse man? And it's like, that's your boss's boss's boss. The next day I get in and there's Xerox copies of male genitalia on my desk, which continued. So it was all out war on women in the day. And that's before you worked all weekend and all night, et cetera. But
and how many women were there?
You know, more than you think. This idea of we just need the pipeline to work its way through, and then we'll have more scene. That's my man voice, by the way.
Right.
Okay. So that's me being a man on Wall Street. And then we'll have more women in senior leadership position on Wall Street. Hasn't been true in decades.
Right.
So it was probably 30-40% of the class were female, no senior females at all. And so my story is I wouldn't let them run me out. I found a company in which I could thrive doing equity research. Company by the name of Sanford Bernstein, very diverse, very eclectic, very intelligent. I called us the land of the misfit toys because we were everyone who Goldman and Morgan Stanley didn't want. My claim to fame is that I took us out of conflicted Wall Street businesses. Mm. We lost a lot of business for it over a lot of years. And then in the internet bubble burst of 2000, 2001, it was clear these conflicts were playing out to the detriment of individual investors. And it was clear laws had been broken. And so our little business soared. I was on the cover of Fortune magazine as the last honest analyst. Mm-hmm. I then went on to run Smith Barney when there was a Smith Barney, the Citi private bank. I was chief financial officer of Citi. My second claim to fame, as mentioned, is that in the financial crisis of 2007, 2008, I was the sole senior executive on Wall Street to return client money. Mm-hmm. Not because you do that when markets go down, but because we had missold products as low risk. Mm-hmm. When they were high risk, they were supposed to go down 8 cents. They went down 100. My boss didn't agree with this decision. The board of directors did. I won and returned the money. And pro tip, take on your boss at the board. You lose your job, you know, pretty much every
time. But
you
keep your integrity.
But I lost a lot of money, but that was okay. That was a night of the long soul for what's important to me, money or... I wouldn't even say ethics because you could argue it both ways. So it was more money or doing what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the way, at least, I always answer that question is, what would I want my children to see me do?
Right.
And as soon as you ask that. And then I went on to run Merrill Lynch after Bank of America bought it and did that, turned it around because it was in true disarray, turned it around and was fired 2 years later or let go after the turnaround. Thanks very much for the turnaround, lady. Now we're going to... But a white dude.
Yeah, 60, of course.
Something-year-old white dude who's never run a business like this before, but is clearly more qualified than you to run it.
But that brings you to Elvis. I mean, so what, as a little girl, were you, what was the driver? I mean, clearly, and I know we're going to talk about this, but you gave me a stat that 61% of women would prefer to talk about death.
Oh, yeah, the majority, finances. Absolutely.
So why were you drawn to Wall Street? Just because that was such an exciting industry?
I was initially drawn to it because it's where the heat was.
Right.
And so I thought, I have this view where every day above ground is a good day. Mm-hmm. Every day is a gift. Just play, you know, just go, right? We're so blessed. So I went there because it's where the heat was. I founded Elevest because of a recognition that the traditional industry has done a terrible job for women, mm-hmm. and blamed them for it. In fact, our entire society, if you begin to notice it, you see it everywhere. Our entire society gives women messages that we're not good with money, that money is for men. What do I mean by that? In homes today, we typically, the father invests, the mother does the budgeting, they talk to the little boy about making money. You know, money is as a source of happiness and power. For females, it's more about budgeting and scarcity and be careful and money is difficult and we get lower grades in math for the same answers as boys. We get lower allowances for the same chores as boys. And so money for us becomes primarily about loneliness and isolation and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a result of it, we prefer to talk about literally anything else than money. And we certainly, by the way, talk about sex. Way more than money, mm-hmm. even though, and this is why it's important, money is today women's number one source of stress. Mm. The act of investing and saving today are the primary drivers, the number one drivers of her confidence in her ability to achieve her future goals, not her job, not her relationship with her partner, the act of taking this step. And the industry, which not coincidentally, is 90% men, 86% of financial advisors are men, 90% of mutual fund managers are men, even though the research indicates women are better investors than men, has done a better job for men than for women. And so, you know, I had people tell me you should start an investing platform for women. And I said, oh, that's so dumb. So dumb. Women don't need their own thing. Money's gender neutral. And when I recognize that we invest so much less than men, blame ourselves for it, and then don't have the hundreds of thousands of dollars in additional wealth mm-hmm. that investing historically has delivered for the typical woman, I thought, okay, I got to do this. Yeah. I don't see anyone else doing it, so looks like it's me.
Why do you think women are better investors when they're sort of empowered or educated? And
because we don't flap. We just don't flap. Men watch CNBC. Mm-hmm. Fox Business, Bloomberg, Reed Barron's, you know, all that stuff. They check their accounts, the research shows you, and therefore the more action you tend to take when you're investing, the worse off you tend to do. Because your emotions typically are not your friend when it comes to investing. We tend to get very optimistic. The market's going up. This is amazing. I feel great. I feel happy. I'm going to invest now. Oh, the market goes down, you freak out, you move. And when you trade, you generate additional cost. Mm-hmm. And so what we women tend to do is invest, and the best way to invest is a little bit out of every paycheck if you're working outside the home and earning a salary outside the home, and then just leave it. Mm. Diversified investment portfolio, the appropriate amount of risk, and just set it on automatic.
So when you created Elvest, was the idea that... Is it primarily staffed by female investors?
It sure is.
Are they all advisors female?
All of our financial advisors are female, but we are a diverse company. We believe in the power of diversity.
Yeah.
So we are today 2/3 women, 45% people of color.
Wow.
And every time we shift to becoming non-diverse, I just stop us hiring. Also importantly, and you and I were talking this beforehand, our venture capitalists, the people who have funded the company, we have probably more and more prominent female venture capitalists than any other company that I know of out there. So we're funded by women and our allies, run by women, helping women invest, in some cases, in other women.
Right.
And so there's this enormous ripple effect that as we sort of get the flywheel kicking in that we can have.
What do you think the repercussions of that are in terms of societal good?
Oh, Oh, I'm so glad you asked, because I can't, you know, I'm a recovering research analyst, Elise, and I have not been able to find a single piece of research that tells me that anything bad happens when women have more money.
Right.
Nothing. Put another way, all good things happen, that it's good, obviously good for women. I mean, you tell me in this, you know, this Time's Up Me Too moment, you and I both know at its core, some part of it, it's about power, which means in some ways it's about money.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, to pick an example, Charlie Rose parading around in his half-open bathrobe, the women who he was doing in front of didn't have as much power, didn't have as much money as he wasn't doing to Gail.
Right.
Right? So, you know, in this moment, it's, you know, it's the power. So we, so the first thing is it's good for women because it's get your hand off my leg money,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm out of this relationship that doesn't work for me money. I'm starting the business I want to money. It's also good for the economy. When we have more money, we spend more money. It's good for society when you equal the genders more. It's good for nonprofits because women give away a larger percent of their wealth.
Yeah.
And it's good, you know, and if you want this government to moderate from, you know, the stuff we're throwing at each other, women tend to give money to and vote for more moderate candidates. So it could also change the complexion of the country.
Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers, and now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
We'll get back to Sally in just a second. I mentioned a few weeks ago on the podcast that curiosity is my favorite state of being. I try to carry that attitude with me every day, and it's certainly easier to do it at a place like Goop that places such a premium value on being curious and feeling empowered to explore and ask questions. Banana Republic is another company that values curiosity. Their founding story starts with a California couple who was looking for an adventure. Fun fact, Banana Republic began as a safari-inspired clothing company, and today, the inspiration for their clothing is designing for a life in motion, or as they put it, living a life of possibilities with no boundaries. Their fall collection is iconic Banana Republic, styled for now. So there are utility-inspired styles made from premium materials. Think your favorite dresses and pants updated in animal prints and menswear patterns, and quintessential suede jackets and cashmere sweaters that you'll wear for many seasons to come. And now, Banana Republic is celebrating some true modern icons with Goop through our special podcast series, Women on Top. I hope you'll listen to every episode. These are the women who lead with power, grace, and curiosity, who I think define what it means to break boundaries, and maybe most importantly, who are working hard so that others too can live a life of possibilities. So keep listening and keep shopping with our friends at Banana Republic. To get their fall collection, head to bananarepublic.com/goop. Over the years, it's become more important to me to prioritize my skin and personalize my routine. Weleda is a skincare company that makes that easier. All of their products are free from parabens, phthalates, and synthetic preservatives and fragrances. They're made up of oils extracted from plants and flowers, and each ingredient is carefully selected to work with your skin. Because, let's face it, skincare can be a little tricky. It can be difficult, even frustrating, to sift through so much information on how to best care for your complexion. Weleda gets that your skin has specific needs and that they can change depending on a host of factors, like the season, where you are in the world, and how stressed you are. So they found effective botanical ingredients to support your skin wherever you're at. And Weleda has designed a quiz that you can take to find the flower best suited to bring balance to your skin with their new skincare profiler. Developed with nearly 100 years of holistic beauty knowledge,
Waleda believes in the power of a personalized skincare routine and that customization is the key to a healthy, radiant complexion. And I've been experimenting with my own skincare routine at night. To make things easy, I've been using Waleda's one-step cleanser and toner, and then I use Waleda's Sensitive Care Calming Oil. It's a light, fragrance-free oil made with almond extract. And then I'm off to bed. To take Waleda's skincare profiler quiz and start customizing your own routine, head to Waleda.com. That's W-E-L-E-D-A. And use promo code GOOP20 for an additional 20% off your purchase. That's G-O-O-P-20.
Back to my chat with Sally Krawcheck. This might be old research and it might be wishful thinking, but I did read it somewhere that people who typically are more altruistic and more generous in turn are better at creating income or creating money for themselves. Like it tends to be a virtuous cycle.
Yeah. I think there is research about it. I can tell you that some of the research that I focus on is investing for our values, which if you had come to me when I was running a Merrill Lynch and said, Sally, we've got an impact fund and it's going to invest for a better environment or a better society, I'd be like, Elise, you're a tree hugger. Mm-hmm. You know, let's just invest for the highest return and give away our money later. And I've completely changed my mind on this. And in fact, I think the industry's come a long way, which is there's no reason from what I can see of the research that investing our values. One of my favorites is investing in companies run by women, that decreases returns. Quite the opposite. The research tells us that more diverse leadership teams have better returns.
Yeah.
And P.S., you know, we talk about impact investing. We're all investing, and every way we spend our money today has impact.
Right.
All of it. Just because we don't know what it is doesn't mean we don't have impact. And we're all investing in a gender today. We're investing in men. Men are amazing. You probably don't want to have 100% of your portfolio in men.
Right.
Probably want to diversify.
Yeah. No, I think some of the research, too, about why diverse teams and more representational teams are more creative, more productive, more effective is fascinating, too, because it's not aligned with comfort.
Exactly. I was going to say exactly that. It's uncomfortable,
yes.
Which is actually where the creativity comes from. It is much more comfortable for me to work with a group of middle-aged white women from the South who've worked in financial services because it's me.
Right.
And so we can all sort of finish each other's sentence. In fact, Elise, I saw this in the financial crisis as the only female on the senior leadership team of Citigroup. What I watched were a bunch of super intelligent, super driven, white male traders who went to the same Ivy Leagues, whose children went to the same schools, whose spouses were friends, who vacationed together, and they would finish each other's sentences. And they missed the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And had they had people with different experiences and backgrounds, there's no guarantee they would have gotten it. But they would have had a much higher chance. I call it the false comfort of agreement.
Yeah.
Which is, hey, we all agree, so we must be right. When, no, you know, there are five of you, but you're essentially the same person, so there should just be one of you.
Exactly. Yeah, like the feelings of familiarity, while deeply comforting, are also lulling us all to sleep and into complacency.
That's right. The challenge, by the way, is that the Wall Street and the investing industry since the financial crisis have actually gone backwards on diversity.
Mm.
You
really?
Would have. I know. See, Elise's. By the way, for those of you who can't hear it, Elise's eyebrows just went up quite a bit.
And you can't, they're very, very
lovely.
They're ungroomed, so it's dramatic.
So they would have made more noise if they had made noise, but they didn't. But you would think it would have become more diverse, but it's not unusual post a crisis that you circle the wagons.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge again is that an undiverse industry doesn't do a great job of serving all of us. It tends to focus on folks like itself.
Totally. And isn't it something like within the millennial generation, 50% are people of color?
Mm-hmm.
Like the world that we're raising looks nothing like the world that's still leading.
It's changing rapidly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's go back to sort of this early conditioning around women and money and why there's so much shame. I think about this a lot, particularly because I feel like women, primarily through training, I've learned, not necessarily because we're better at it, are are inherently more empathic, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and I think that triggers more shame. I feel like the women I know who have money certainly give a lot away, but they feel like they're never doing enough.
Oh.
What's the root of it?
Well, I think it's they feel guilty about it. And then they also worry, even wealthy women tend to worry that we're going to become bag ladies. And
yeah.
One of the things that's interesting is when you speak to the genders about money, they both will use a water analogy. And for men, it's a river. And the money comes in and the money goes out and the level goes up and the level goes down. But there's a sense of abundance. And for women, it's a pond. Mm-hmm. And this is how much money I've got. And I have to protect it, and it goes one direction and down. Anyway, so where does it come from? I think, to use a loaded word, from a patriarchal society, mm-hmm. that for forever the man earned the money, had the power, and, you know, the 1940s housewife is, you know, given an allowance and working on coming within budget, mm-hmm. and polite society, you don't talk about money. How much money do you make, Daddy? We don't talk about that. How much did you pay for the car? We don't talk about that.
Right.
And so we've received, we look up and we see our parents and there's Dad investing. You know, just 2% of U.S. households today does the woman take the lead in investing.
Mm.
So we look up, we see our parents. If both parents work, still today, if the woman makes more money than the man does, both of them lie to the government about it.
Really?
Yes. He says he makes more and she says she makes less.
Interesting.
And so I think it goes back to those traditional roles. What I like to do, Elise, if you had provided me with wine when I had gotten here and we were 3 glasses in, and I was quite, 3 glasses of wine will do it for me.
By the way, we've had wine before, and you've asked me this question, and I told you, and you almost fell off your chair. I know it's coming. You didn't expect me to tell you.
No, it might be different. All right, because I drink a lot of wine, actually, at least. But if we'd had 3 glasses, I would say if the guys got together 100 years ago and said, let's keep the women down,
right?
This is what they would have done.
Right.
Let's keep the money out of their hands and let's make money a topic of shame and loneliness. And let's make it so that you don't talk about money in polite society. Ha, ha, ha. Then women can't ask for raises because they don't even know what to ask for.
Right.
By the way, it'll keep them out of the money industries. So Wall Street will be mostly men. Venture capital will be mostly men. So they won't invest in much and they won't get their businesses funded. Now, I don't think that happened. But to the best of my knowledge, that didn't happen.
Right. But you did ask. You were like, how much money do you make?
Oh,
and then you
I do remember this.
When I actually
That's right. Yeah, I was shocked when you answered it. But do you know, actually, since then, when this happened, we had a drink together. And I'm like, so what do you make? And she actually told me. But I was on a panel since then. And the woman who I was talking to, when I said, women prefer to talk about their own death instead of money. And she said, that's not true. And I said, yes, it is. She said, that's not true. And I said, buried or cremated? And she said, buried. And then I said, how much money did you make? And the poor woman, her lips were like a fish. They just kept opening and closing. And I'm like, oh, dear goodness me. Is she going to say it? And then she's going to hate me for forever. And I'm like, you don't have to say it.
That's
You're
amazing.
The only one who's ever said it.
Isn't that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll take
the compliment.
I'll take the compliment. Mm-hmm. I do agree. I think it would... be very clarifying. And I think whenever you talk about things that are shameful, they cease to be shameful. It's funny, the bag lady idea. I don't remember if I told you this, but my mom actually went on Donahue.
No.
To talk about, which is so random, I don't even know how this happened because we lived in Missoula, Montana, and my mom had it wasn't like she was connected to anyone in Hollywood or on the Phil Donahue production team, but she went on Donahue with Gloria Steinem and Lily Tomlin to talk about her fear of becoming a bag lady. Have I told this story before?
No.
Okay. Yeah, so this was in the 80s. I remember watching her at my friend's house, and it's a real and abiding and persistent fear.
Yeah.
And it was such a moment in the 80s, I think, but she sustains it to this day. And she was heckled. by this woman in the audience. He was enraged that my mom, who's married to a doctor, would talk, you know, essentially the audience member was like, there's no way you will ever be homeless. But and it's so irrational, obviously. But I think for whatever reason, there is something deep in all of us.
Because, and again, I think it hits into this lone, we're not talking about it, the loneliness, the shame.
Yeah.
We make, you know, if you make too much money, you feel bad to your girlfriends.
Yeah.
If you make too little money, you feel bad to your parents because they spend. I mean, you just feel there's not an amount of money we make where you're like, score.
And I think it's hard to grow up in a house where there is a completely healthy relationship around it. And my mom grew up in a Catholic family, the oldest of seven, food scarcity, certainly no abundance. And
it's the only thing my parents fought about was money. It's interesting because I was on a different podcast. And they said, we're going to talk about uncomfortable things. We're going to talk about money. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what I do. And then they started asking me about how much money I had.
Interesting.
And what was it like to have this much money? And I'm telling you, Elise, I pitted out. I mean, this is my profession and has been my profession for decades. And I actually could feel the bead of sweat roll from my armpit down my bra and into my skirt. And I was like, we just have to stop. Like, I can't do this.
Because why?
Because of the shame. Because of the, what are people going to think if they know I've got this money or this amount of money? It's for all of us. See, I'm already blathering, even me. It's crazy.
And do you feel like men have no problem talking about it?
I don't want to generalize. But look, they may or may not have a problem talking about it, but they make more money than we do.
Exactly.
So for us, you know, our challenge is, and a friend of mine was saying this to me not so long ago, you walk into work at a typical company and you have a 20% tax for being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, most women don't realize it. We actually did a survey at Elevest in which these women, nope, not me, right, not me. And so we have a greater need to talk about it than men do.
I also think just because we're obviously underrepresented in terms of executive teams, board seats, leadership across the country, and there is some clarity that's provided by like Bloomberg, right? Like you can typically look up an executive's salary, probably not all of their holdings and how much equity they might have, et cetera. But there are some markers that exist in the media. But obviously they're covering
senior levels.
Far more men.
Right, right. Well, and look, you sort of bring this up. The next iteration of this and the challenge we've faced is we somehow got convinced as women that we were competing against each other.
Yeah.
And so that camaraderie of, you know, you're grabbing a coffee in the, you know, rec room, you know, and you might have these conversations, hasn't existed for us, that we looked up and saw the leadership table and saw there was one woman there or two women there, maybe
the
one person of color.
Yeah.
And you knew intuitively, certainly in my generation, I knew intuitively that I wasn't necessarily competing against all the guys. I was competing against the woman.
Right.
If there was that one seat at the table, there weren't going to be three of us.
Yeah.
And so it got even worse where we were pitted against each other. And you and I have talked about the queen bee, that woman who kicked the ladder out from under her, was actually an economic creature.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've had some, you know, I'll go to a dinner in New York City with women of a certain age and buy that third glass of wine. One of them will be like, yep, I was that woman. I kicked out the younger women because I wasn't ready to give up my position. I'm like, wow, you just said that.
Yeah. But no, again, you go back to survival and scarcity sort of this false model that we've all been living under.
And then the challenge is that real change hasn't been happening in corporate America, that it's stalled out, it hasn't been as rapid. And then we look around and we see what can affect real change, which is our coming together.
Yeah.
You know, one of us asking for the raise is defeatable. All of us coming together and saying this parental leave policy is for the birds.
Yeah.
You know, it'll make the workplace better for everybody if we have a humane parental leave policy and make the company better. That can work.
Yeah.
But we've been so isolated, we just haven't been doing it.
Totally. And I think that then you get into those hazing circles, right, where people who have suffered through horrendous maternity leave policies aren't incented or they're bitter about it.
Oh,
and so it's hard to make it better.
The research tells us, and it's so counterintuitive, that when we have been through something tough, we have less empathy for other people who are going through it.
Yeah.
That, you know, I didn't have a great maternity leave, you know, policy, then why should you? I did it. It must be a coping mechanism. You just sort of poo-poo it. I saw it with my daughter. I adore my daughter. After she went through the college admissions process, which was a moment, and then her cousins went through, she's like, oh, please, they need to get over it. And I'm like, do you remember the drama? And she's like, oh, please, it's nothing. It's going to turn out fine.
So ripe, right?
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes a new movie called Challengers, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya plays Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who transforms her husband, Art, into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt her husband out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event, close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when Art finds himself standing across a net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Tensions run high as past and present collide. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26. Get tickets now at challengersmovie.com.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
We're going to take a quick break. Okay, here's a movie that will draw you to the theaters. The Goldfinch, from Warner Brothers Pictures and Amazon Studios, is based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. It's about a boy named Theodore Theo Decker, who is played by two talented actors. Ansel Elgort plays Theo as an adult, and Oakes Fegley plays him as a child. In the beginning of the story, when Theo is just 13 years old, his mother is tragically killed in a bombing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. This moment, and an ill-fated split-second decision that Theo makes in its aftermath, changes everything. From here, we follow Theo's remarkable journey through grief and guilt, redemption and love. All along, he's both haunted and propelled by the one piece of hope that he clings to from that day in the museum, a painting of a tiny bird chained to its perch, the Goldfinch. This is a beautiful coming-of-age story about the ripple effects of a single event. It's directed by John Crowley, whose work you might know and love from Brooklyn. And it also stars Finn Wolfhard, Anirin Barnard, Sarah Paulson, Luke Wilson, Jeffrey Wright, and Academy Award winner Nicole Kidman. The Goldfinch is now playing in theaters everywhere, so go check it out. And now, back to today's conversation. So when you were thinking about, like, in terms of marketing, how do you change the way that you bring these products to women? Are there sort of financial literacy hurdles that you need to get women over until they feel, because I feel like being on an executive team, sitting in board meetings, which has been my first experience of that, is fascinating because, like, you just learn on the fly. I think women, though, obviously we feel like we need to know everything.
For sure.
Before we can make a decision.
Well, that's been a barrier to us because, you know, my research showed years ago when I was at one of the big firms that 84% of our clients didn't understand what a managed account was. It was their biggest selling product. Neither gender would ask. The men would buy it and the women wouldn't. Mm. And so this drive we have, again, socialized to get those A's, be perfect, you know, really
has
gotten.
Do all the research.
And you actually look at this and say, ooh, who's the smarter gender? And in this case, it's the men, because they might not have understood it, but at least they were investing, which in a typically upward trending equity market was the winning strategy. And so, first of all, we did a few things. First of all, most of the initiatives before Elevest were marketing. Mm-hmm. Now, they were patronizing. Don't buy the shoes, you know, don't buy the one that drives me nuts. Don't buy the latte, invest the money and become a millionaire. In what frigging planet?
Right.
Right? Not on this one does that translate, but that's this this sort of, let me make you feel guilty. Let me, you know, give you the soundbite, which isn't useful in really addressing these challenges. So first of all, there were marketing. And then, so we really changed the product. And what we found is that what seems to motivate men, at least in the existing industry, outperforming, beating the market, buying and selling stocks, is not motivating for women. What is motivating for women is, help me identify my goal, help me see if it's achievable, and invest to get me there in the vast majority of markets. That's very different than I want to make the most money, okay? And so what we did was we built a different way of investing called goals-based investing, where you would come in and say, I'm Elise, I'm a 22-year-old.
Yeah, girl.
Exactly. Woman making $1 zillion.
21.
And no kids. Everything's easy breezy. And, you know, I want to buy a home in 5 years. I want to have a baby in 10 years. I want to start a bit. I want to retire, whatever. And then we use a very powerful underlying algorithm that takes into account, the only one that takes into account that you live longer than men do, and that unfortunately our salaries peak sooner, to put together an investment portfolio for you. You can also come in and just have a build wealth and just I want to invest. So we were the first to really hit on what is it that this gender has been looking for. From there, we said, it doesn't have to be that hard.
Yeah.
Right? Let's take out the jargon, turn it into plain English, and get back to the fundamentals of a diversified investment portfolio with an appropriate amount of risk that we rebalance for you and shift for you over time. That's it.
Yeah.
Right? We're a fiduciary. We're obligated by law to act in your best interest. We've got decades and decades of experience. That's what we do.
How much of it was, how much market research did you do versus the psychographics of yourself? Because I think
thousands of hours.
Okay.
Actually, I came in with a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a swagger. I worked on Wall Street forever and I was a research analyst and I'm a woman. So I got this. And you know what was really interesting? Our first product was to help women get over their emotions around investing. That's what I thought was needed.
Mm.
And we built it and spent quite a bit of money on it. And we got flipped the proverbial bird because the feedback that came back from women was, I have plenty of emotional issues around money. I don't want to solve them with you. I'll go to my psychiatrist couch,
right?
You know, or my whatever, but I'm not interested with you. And what we found is she's very practical.
Yeah.
I'm here. I want to get there. And can I do it? And at Elevest, you can get through. If you do the full goals based, you make trade-offs, you do it in 15 minutes. If you do I want to invest, you can do it in 5.
Yeah.
Personally, my head of compliance will shoot me. But historically, it's been the highest return use of 5 or 15 minutes on the friggin' planet.
Mm.
Right? Think about it. And I'm going to put in one side note, and then I want to talk about marketing. Again, we tend to, as women, overestimate how risky the equity markets have been. If I were to tell you that since the 1920s, if you invested on any day, and stayed in the markets, the equity markets for 15 years, which is what you should do, you should invest, you know, risky for the short term, your chances of a positive return over that 15 years was 99%.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Even me, I spent my life in this, I thought that's higher than I would have guessed. And so we've been missing those returns. And so, you know, putting together this portfolio, showing her if she's on or off track to reach her goal, hit the sweet spot of what women have been looking for. But it's the highest return use historically.
How much are people investing? What's the typical account size?
Well, this is the exciting part. We have no minimum. So when I'm going to say something a little shocking, but these account minimums for these investing firms are sexist and racist. She just said that. Because who's got the more money? The cis white men.
Right.
Right? And so you've kept that accessibility away from us. So we have no minimum at all. You could open an account with a penny. I can't give you a diversified investment portfolio until you put in a dollar. And so we've got women and men, all genders, who have a dollar in, who have millions of dollars in with us. It's really across the spectrum. And what we find is typically an individual will start with some amount of money and then will invest a bit out of every paycheck or put in a bonus or a raise. And so those numbers grow over time, both as the market has appreciated as well as from existing, you know, additional investments.
So what's the ultimate goal? Is it to be sort of the Charles Schwab of the future.
World domination, baby.
Yeah.
No, well, look, the ultimate goal really is to get more money in the hands of women. And our first initiative here is through investing. But whatever we can do to take care of that number one source of stress, to help her feel more in financial control, to provide her with the capabilities where she's got the confidence. I mean, look, we spend so much time, all of us, on, you know, wellness and self-care and how do we take care of ourselves. This is the core of us, core of it. And particularly in a capitalist society. And so for us, the real goal is not, I want the business to be this big. I want my time on earth, when I leave here, that I've helped more women have more confidence and therefore had a real impact.
And is there, this might be too in the weeds, but what's your recommendation? Let's say women have, is it that they max out their 401k?
Great question. Okay, so here's the order in which one wants to do it. If you have high interest rate debt outstanding, credit card debt, maybe an auto loan, anything above sort of 7% interest rate, the first thing you want to do is pay that off.
Mm-hmm.
Anything below 4 or 5, you can leave outstanding, obviously pay the amounts that are due. Anywhere in between is sort of, you know, house's choice.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm good with it. Why do I have that level? Because that's the types of returns that you can get over time in the markets. The second thing you want to do is build up an emergency fund. 3 months if you're younger, 6 months if you're more mature, of your take-home pay, you know, as your life gets more complicated, that's there for the roof caved in or, you know, Fido got sick or all the things, I lost my job, all the things that happen. Then if you have a 401k at work or you have an IRA, the third thing typically is to invest in that. You want to do that next because you get the tax benefits of it, so it grows more quickly over time. And you want to start young because the power of compounding, earning returns on the returns on the returns, is really important. You want to shoot for, of your take-home pay, 20% of it going to future you. And that's future you a few years, you're buying a home and you want a 20% down payment. And that's future you going around the world, but that's future grandma you. My future grandma's named Esther. I don't know what yours is named, but you got to take care of Esther.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you might not be able to do 20%. So start with one.
Yeah.
Start with 0.5% of out of every paycheck, some amount, you know, that is put away for you. And if you can't do it for yourself, do it for your kids.
Yeah.
Right? By taking care of yourself, you're taking care of them. So pay down the credit card debt, get that emergency fund, invest in retirement, and then begin investing into a regular type of account like the ones we do have retirement accounts at LFS, but regular investing accounts as well. And then I want everybody on the podcast, if you use the code GOOP, you'll have $50 put into your account. So I have
sweet.
Now, so you can either go LFS.com/goop or you can go through the app and type in the gift code GOOP. I've now taken away every excuse you have because this is literally no risk at this point, right? Literally no risk. So just go through and, you know, if it goes up, that's going to be amazing. I like to say, when is $50 not $50? When you invest it.
Right.
Because the returns that you've historically earned. And if it goes down, so what? It was free.
Exactly.
Right? But at least just get in there and start doing it and seeing yourself as an investor and becoming attuned to it.
Yeah. I also feel like maybe this is naughty or not honest, but I feel like it's wise for particularly for women who don't necessarily control the finances to have their own accounts.
Well, first of all, so you're bringing up a very important point. 90% of women manage their money on their own, whether they want to or not.
Mm.
My first marriage, I was certain we would be buried next to each other. My ex-husband is now married to my ex-friend.
Wow.
I know.
Bearing the lead of this podcast.
How about that? How about that? Sorority sister, too, from back in the day. Yes, I was.
Holy bananas.
I know. Well, hope they're happy. She says in a flinty-edged voice. I was sure of it, Elise. I was sure of it. And now, you know, also I'm getting to the age where some of my friends have lost their husbands.
Yeah.
So 80% of women die single. We live on average 6 to 8 years longer than our spouses if we're in heterosexual relationships. So whether we want to or not, we're going to deal with money. But here's actually the real driver. It drives more happiness in marriage. Or let me say it's correlated with happiness in marriage. Couples who talk about money every week, something like 78% of them report to being very happy. Whereas couples who aren't talking about money even monthly, it's only half of them who report to being happy. So I don't know where my chicken is versus my egg, but it leads to marital happiness. Like nothing bad here, right? Nothing bad, except we were taught that money is essentially male.
Thanks, Sally. And thanks for the $50. I'm going to invest it
wisely. Right this second.
It's free.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Sally Krawcheck. You can learn more about her and Elvest at elvest.com. That's ELLEVEST. That's it for today's episode. If you have a chance, please rate and review. Hit subscribe to keep up with new episodes and pass it along to a friend. Thanks again for joining. I hope you'll come back this Thursday for more. And in the meantime, you can check out goop.com/thepodcast.